The capital to everyone is goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
These are the top stories. Israel keeps pounding the besieged Gaza Strip. At least 35 Palestinians, including 12 children, have been killed in the strikes since Monday. Palestinians fire hundreds of rockets toward Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities that target a pipeline in response to Israel's aggression. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei urges Palestinians to increase their power to stop Israel's brutality, stressing that Zionists only understand the language of force. Greetings everyone, those were the top stories, welcome. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has fired more rockets into Israel as tensions run high between the two sides. Hamas said it fired more than 200 rockets toward Tel Aviv and the town of Be'er Sheva. A pipeline between the cities of Eilat and Ashkelon was hit as well. Hamas says the salvo was in response to Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. At least 35 Palestinians, including 12 children and 3 women, have been killed in the regime's attack since Monday. This as 4 Israelis have been killed in retaliatory attacks by the Palestinians. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has declared that the resistance front will remain steadfast in its fight against Israeli crimes. He says the group is ready no matter what actions Tel Aviv takes.
If they want to escalate, the resistance is ready. If they want to stop, the resistance is ready. If they want to move their hand out of Jerusalem al-Quds, the resistance is ready. This is the message that we deliver to all the sides and to whoever is involved.
Haniyeh said Palestinians will never leave Jerusalem al-Quds alone and will continue to fight to protect the city from Israeli forces. Meanwhile, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs has threatened that strikes on Gaza have just started. Benny Gantz said buildings in Gaza will, quote, continue to crumble. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also warned that Hamas and Islamic Jihad will pay a heavy price. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian and injured another one near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. This comes as the regime is pushing ahead with a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds. Footage from al-Quds shows Israeli forces repeatedly punched an unarmed Palestinian man near the city's Damascus Gate. The regime's forces were also captured beating a Palestinian teenager in the city's Bab al-Asbat area. Meanwhile, the mayor of Lod has declared a state of emergency in response to what he described as a complete loss of control and a civil war in the city. He further asked the Israeli army to impose a curfew and restore calm. Tensions are also running high elsewhere across the occupied West Bank, including the cities of Rahat and Baga. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Palestinians should boost their power and resistance to force Israel into submission and secession of its brutal measures. In a virtual meeting with various student organizations, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the Israeli regime only understands the language of force. He hailed the vigilant steadfastness and firm resolve of the Palestinian nation. Iran's leader said the Israeli crimes are committed before the very eyes of the world, and so everyone should condemn the acts of aggression and fulfill their duty. More international reactions are pouring in over Israeli attacks against Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the besieged Gaza Strip. The UN envoy for Middle East warned that the situation is escalating into a full-scale war and called for an immediate stop to attacks. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also expressed deep concern over the flare-up. He said he was working with all relevant parties to urgently de-escalate the situation. The Arab League condemned the airstrikes on Gaza as indiscriminate and irresponsible. The African Union denounced the regime's bombings, that is, in the besieged enclave. UK-based Amnesty International accused Israel of using unlawful and abusive force against peaceful Palestinian demonstrators. Well, people have taken to the streets across the world to condemn Israel's crackdown on Palestinian protesters in the West Bank and the regime's aggression against the Gaza Strip. Washington, D.C. demonstrators rallied outside the U.S. State Department in support of Palestinians. They condemned Washington's silence on Israeli crimes while asking for de-escalation following the Palestinians' response. In Turkey, protesters gathered outside the Israeli consulate in Istanbul for a third night in a row. They called on Ankara to sever ties with Tel Aviv. In Kuwait, demonstrators marched in the capital to voice their solidarity with the beleaguered people in the Gaza Strip and against the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in a neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Similar protests were held in central London, where flag-waving demonstrators chanted slogans calling for an end to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem Al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the arms trade treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When, following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iyah, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Now, the European Union's Brexit negotiator has warned Britain to fully apply the terms of its departure from the bloc or risk losing credibility on the global stage. Michel Barnier said Britain is not doing its commitments on fishing in Northern Ireland. He urged London to respect the Brexit terms on those two crucial issues approved in the two agreements in 2019 and 2020. The EU has already launched legal proceedings against Britain over a unilateral six-month delay to imposing customs controls on goods arriving in Northern Ireland from Britain. Tensions also flared last week over fishing when French boats massed at the Channel Island of Jersey, claiming that they were being denied licenses to fish off its shores despite a Brexit pledge of continued access. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell describes efforts to save the Iran nuclear deal as an extremely delicate and sensitive process. The bloc's top diplomat has been discussing the topic with EU foreign affairs ministers in Brussels. Jerome Hughes is in the Belgian capital.
A lot of work is needed and time is limited. That's what Josep Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, has told a ministerial meeting in Brussels with respect to ongoing talks in Vienna to try and save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
It's an effort to make the US to go back to the agreement in order to have a full compliance for Iran, which is the best way to ensure the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran nuclear program.
Tehran insists it has zero ambition to build a nuclear bomb. The idea that Iran wants a nuclear weapon is peddled by Tel Aviv and the Israel lobby in the US, according to unbiased security experts.
Where is the evidence, they ask? How many times has Washington launched attacks on foreign nations without any justification?
Critics say the West's meddling in the Middle East has caused immeasurable damage.
Well, the biggest failing of all was the, you know, intervention of the United States into Iraq, you know, after 9/11, because this created a security vacuum.
EU and US foreign policy was recently debated in the European Parliament.
We must work for stability in Iran and Iraq and Lebanon, a peace in Syria and Yemen, and oppose the US-Saudi attempts to isolate Iran.
The Iran nuclear agreement, underpinned by the UN, was thrown into flux when Donald Trump pulled the US out of the accord 3 years ago this month. He then imposed harsh, illegal economic sanctions on Iran. Saving the nuclear deal would help to bring stability to the region, it has been suggested.
You know, Middle East, it is a vital area. We should to make it a quiet area because, you know, it is on the middle of the trade road, so it will affect all the economy situation in all the world.
Josep Borrell has told EU foreign affairs ministers the talks in Vienna, Austria, are extremely delicate, sensitive and intense. He says he's optimistic and a window of opportunity will stay open until the end of this month. Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, he insists. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And a demonstration has been held in the Iranian capital to condemn Saturday's multiple explosions in Kabul that killed scores of people, most of them little girls. Demonstrators gathered outside the Afghan embassy to express solidarity with Afghanistan. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation echoed from Tehran following the deadly terrorist raid on Saturday that killed dozens of schoolgirls in Kabul. Scores of people lost their lives in explosions caused by car bomb and mortar shells targeting a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. Eyewitnesses reported that the victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home after finishing school.
I offer my condolences to the bereaved mothers of the innocent girls who lost their lives in the terrorist attack. I hold the Afghan government responsible for its inaction regarding terrorism and extremism.
We came here to express our sympathy with our fellow Afghan citizens. The fact that the terrorists committed to this heinous crime in the fasting month of Ramadan shows that they have no respect for Muslim citizens.
While Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the Kabul attack, demonstrators here blame the incident on U.S. war of Afghanistan, They say American forces have been on the ground in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But in fact, they've been fueling the flames of terrorism. Last week, the U.S. and its NATO allies began pulling their troops and military hardware out of Afghanistan, a measure which these people say is too late.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it is always after creating chaos and insecurity by finding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it's always after creating chaos and insecurity by funding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
In a gesture of solidarity, Tehran also held this video mapping on its iconic Azadi Tower. The video projection depicted messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation. The killing of the innocent schoolgirls has touched the hearts of all Muslims beyond Afghan borders. Demonstrators here say the tragic incident is a clear proof that Daesh terrorists have nothing to do with Islam, but are the enemies of Muslims. They say it's time for all Muslims to join hands and uproot Takfiri terrorism. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has officially launched registration of hopefuls for presidential election. The five-day registration ends on May the 15th, when the Constitutional Council will decide who can run for the position. Our correspondent, Human Abedi, has the details.
Iran, Tehran, the Interior Ministry, the elections office of the country, which is now registering the hopefuls for the upcoming June presidential elections. Over 20 public figures have officially announced their intention to run for president, but the final list of candidates will be announced by the Constitution Council on May 27th. This man was the first luminary showing up, Mohammad Hassan Nami, an army general who ministered telecoms during President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told at a brief presser that he has tens of plans for the country's future, especially in the economic fields.
I have 62 programs for my administration when I would be elected. The main six ones will be performed within the first 6 months of my term. It mainly focuses on improving the life quality of people, especially in economic terms.
The next salient figure who signed up on the first day was Saeed Mohammad, another man with military backgrounds who has served as the commander of the IRGC's construction base.
My likely government will certainly abide by the agreements reached by the incumbent administration. So as the 2015 nuclear deal is an international deal, we will comply with our commitments. This is the other side that has withdrawn from the pact unilaterally.
The third one was the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani, who is now serving as an advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Particularly with regard to the public livelihood, people's livelihood. Well, that has so much details, but within 2 years, I will be in contact with different associations, guilds, and the university professors. I have had face-to-face talks with them in the past 2 years, and that has been delineated on the basis of the facts and realities in the society.
Apart from these three, Wahab Azizi, Secretary General of Jihad Garan Party, and Mohammad Zarif Humani, Secretary General of Popular Party of Reforms, appeared to announce their bid. Some top political figures are also seen as possible presidential hopefuls, but they have not declared their decision yet. They include former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, Judiciary Chief Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, current Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baghir Qalibaf, and Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new interpretation of the Constitutional Council of the Election Law says that runners must be between 40 and 75 years of age with at least 4 years of managerial experience with no criminal records. This as the former military personnel must have served as major general. With these conditions in, several of the current hopefuls may be out of the race. Human Abedi, Tehran.
That's it for me.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
the month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with the last episode of the special series for Ramadan. The month of Ramadan was the best period for attaining proximity of God through obeying His commands. The Noble Quran in many ayahs calls on us to be hopeful of God's mercy and forgiveness. Ayah 87 of Surah Yusuf, for instance, reads, "Do not despair of Allah's mercy. Indeed, no one despairs of Allah's mercy except the faithless lot." In view of this, despair of God's mercy is one of the greatest sins in Islam. Hope is a valuable gift from God. Hope and optimism strengthen positive thinking in human being, and positive thinking will double man's motive to continue life with more energy. Such a person will make this utmost effort to reach lofty goals. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "I swear by the one which there is no God but him, that the goodness of the world and the hereafter will not be attained by a faithful unless through optimism, hoping God's favor, good morals, and refraining from backbiting the faithful." Eid al-Fitr is the first day of the Islamic month of Shawwal and one of the greatest Islamic feasts. Fasting is haram or religiously forbidden on this day. In fact, it is the day of thankfulness to God for fasting the blessed month of Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Adorn your feast with takbir, saying, Allahu Akbar." In another hadith, he is narrated as saying, "Adorn the feast of Fitr and Adha with La ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar, walhamdulillahi wa subhanallah." The end of the 1 month of fasting is a joyous gift from God, which is manifested in Eid al-Fitr. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "When the crescent of the month of Shawwal appears, the angels raise their voices, saying, O faithful, come and receive your gifts." Imam Ali, peace upon him, also says, "Know that the nearest thing that has been made for the faithful men and women is that, on the last day of the month of Ramadan, an angel calls on behalf of God, O servants of God, take this good news that God has forgiven your past sins. So think on your future and new life as how you will live." In the last episode of this series, let us recite the special supplication of Imam Sajjad for bidding farewell to the month of Ramadan. Farewell to you, the best companion of times. Farewell to you, the best month in days and hours. Farewell to you, the month in which the aspirations neared and the good deeds increased. Farewell to you, the companion whose being is valuable and whose loss is sad and the source of hope whose departure is painful. Farewell to you, the companion whose coming causes calm and whose going is horrible. Farewell to you, the neighbor in which the hearts were softened and the sins decreased. Farewell to you, as you brought us blessings and washed away the pollution of our sins. Farewell to you, while we have no grudge from you or any bitterness of your fasting. Farewell to you, that we desired you before your coming and sad before your departure. Farewell to you and your night of Qadr, which is better than 1,000 months. Farewell to you, as we were so attached to you yesterday, and we will be so eager to you tomorrow. O God, we are the people of this month whereby you ennobled us and helped us with your favor, while the wretched ignored it and were deprived of its grace due to their misery. And it is you who has chosen us for its recognition and guided us for its tradition. And indeed, you have been our patron in helping us to fast and pray in it, although we have come short in it and fulfilled little of much. O God, all praises belong to you. While we admit our evil deeds and confess our destructive acts, while we are remorseful in our hearts and apologize you with honest tongues, so for the shortcoming that we have done in this month in relation to your obedience, reward us in a way that we achieve desirable grace and attain various savings that we have been yearning for, and accept our apology in shortcoming to fulfill your right and prolong our life till the next month of Ramadan. And when we reach the next Ramadan, help us worship you as it behooves you, and take us to the position that behooves your obedience, and make us do the deeds that will fulfill your right in this Ramadan and the next one. O God, bless Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad, and compensate for our calamity of departure of our month, and bless us in your feast and breaking the fast, and make it among the best days that have lapsed and brought your pardon and removed our sins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Israel has been boasting that its rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine has been the most successful in the world, and that it's inoculated a higher percentage of its population than anyone else. What Israel has not been telling you is that they're only counting their Jewish population. The Palestinians living under Israeli occupation have been purposely excluded from receiving the vaccine. Today we look at the truth behind Israel's claim and their medical apartheid towards the Palestinian people. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Right now, countries all across the world are buying up stocks of the COVID-19 vaccine in order to inoculate their populations after a year of lockdowns and restrictions. There are several vaccines being developed, like the Sputnik vaccine, a collaboration under Russia, or the Pfizer vaccine, which is the one that Israel has been buying up. Israel made a deal for an undisclosed amount with Pfizer, which would also provide the pharmaceutical giant with data and health information about its population. Israel began rolling out the vaccine in December 2020, which requires that each person take 2 shots 3 weeks apart. Israel, of course, never misses a chance to show off, and Netanyahu has been proudly boasting about how fast he was able to secure so many doses of the vaccine and administer them to his population. And the media has also been singing Israel's praises, citing it as an example of efficiency. The New York Times writing that Israel has become a world leader in vaccinating against COVID-19. And it's true. If you look at the figures, Israel has a higher rate of inoculation than anyone else. The problem is, those numbers are lying. Those numbers do not include the 5 million Palestinians living under Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The Guardian first reported on January 3rd, 2021, how Israel transports batches of the Pfizer vaccine deep into the West Bank, but they are only distributed to Jewish settlers and not the roughly 2.7 million Palestinians living around them, who may have to wait for weeks or months. According to the BBC, Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, which is also under illegal occupation, are entitled to be vaccinated as they're considered residents. However, Palestinians living in the West Bank or in Gaza, being illegally occupied by Israel, are not. The only people in those areas that are entitled to be vaccinated are the Zionist settlers who are living there illegally. Israel's military occupation, its Zionist settlements, these are all illegal under international law. There are numerous UN Security Council resolutions clearly, unequivocally stating that Israel must leave and that these settlements are illegal under international law. Matthias Kennis, a medic from Doctors Without Borders who works in the West Bank, also wrote in late February how he was shocked by Israel's cruelty, saying, quote, "You are over 60 times more likely to have a vaccination in Israel than in Palestine." Kennis goes on to say that a few kilometers away in Israel, all the vulnerable groups have been vaccinated, and they are planning to move on to vaccinating healthy adults and youths who are less vulnerable, especially to severe complications. Here in the West Bank, there are around 10,000 doses, which is enough for 5,000 people to be vaccinated. In the hospital where I work, staff have been offered the vaccine, but the available doses do not come close to covering the healthcare workers, let alone the elderly and people with medical conditions that make them susceptible to dying of COVID-19. The United States Senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders wrote a joint letter with other senators urging Secretary of State Blinken to pressure Israel to vaccinate Palestinians. In the letter, it states that, quote, "While the Oslo Accords give the Palestinian Authority considerable responsibility for the health care of Palestinians, the Accords do not supersede Israel's responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention." And this is absolutely correct. Because you see, this is what the Israelis are trying to argue. They're claiming that they have no legal obligation to vaccinate Palestinians, despite the fact that they're illegally occupying Palestinians. The Israelis claim that under the Oslo Accords of 1995, if you look at Annex 3, Article 17, it says, quote, "Powers and responsibilities in the sphere of health in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be transferred to the Palestinian side, including the health insurance system." However, under Article 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it says that, quote, "The occupying power," which is Israel in this case, "has the duty of ensuring and maintaining, with the cooperation of national and local authorities, the medical and hospital establishments and services, public health and hygiene in the occupied territory, with particular reference to the adoption and application of the prophylactic and preventative measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics." It's important to note, however, that the Oslo Accords, they were a bilateral agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. The Geneva Convention is much larger than that, much older than that. It's a pillar of international law. So it's completely irrational and unreasonable to argue that the Oslo Accords somehow cancel out or supersede the Geneva Convention, which Israel and Palestine are both a party to. Also, even if you want to take the Israelis' argument at face value, how can you expect the Palestinians to be in charge of their own health affairs when Israel is occupying them? How are Palestinians expected to run an efficient healthcare system and build public health infrastructure when they are told what they can and can't import, when they are told when and where they can go, when they don't even have a state, when they're living under a brutal Zionist occupation that denies them their basic human rights. And if the occupation wasn't bad enough, every single time Israel viciously bombs Gaza, it purposely targets civilian and public health infrastructure. And while Mr. Erdan, who is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, claims on Twitter that the Palestinian Authority is responsible for its own health affairs and that Israel will facilitate their purchase of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia. Well, hold on a second. Why would Israel need to facilitate Palestinians' purchase of a vaccine if Palestinians are responsible for their own health affairs? There's a bit of a contradiction there, don't you think? And of course, even that turned out to be a lie. When Gaza tried to import vaccines from Russia, Israel blocked it. A shipment of a mere 1,000 doses, which is barely enough for 500 people, was still blocked by Israel. This is so emblematic of their wicked treatment towards Palestinians. According to Al Jazeera, Israeli lawmakers were even debating whether to let in vaccines out of fear that they would go to Hamas leadership. Well, here's a solution. Why not just give all Palestinian civilians vaccines? Then you won't have to worry about that, right? So Israel even waited 3 months. Since December, they waited 3 months before giving vaccines to the 100,000 plus Palestinians that it uses as cheap labor who cross over into Israel every day. Here's a PR photo that they put out in some depraved attempt to make themselves look like humanitarian occupiers and whitewash their occupation. I mean, it's so dehumanizing. Israel still has millions of vaccines, while millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have none. And like with all criticisms of Zionism, Israel grew furious when people began calling out its racist medical apartheid towards Palestinians. The Guardian was accused of lying and asked to apologize over its articles. Even Michael Che, who joked on Saturday Night Live about Israel only vaccinating its Jewish population, was accused of racism. Netanyahu, along with Danny Dunan and several other Israeli officials, quickly rushed to accuse him of anti-Semitism. So while the Israelis have been able to enjoy an easing of lockdown restrictions and a drop in infections of COVID-19, just earlier this month, on March 11, Palestinians saw their worst day yet with a record 27 fatalities and 2,300 registered cases in a single day. And while Palestinians have been able to acquire some 2,000 doses from Israel, 10,000 doses of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, and another 60,000 doses delivered by the United Nations through its COVAX program, this is nowhere near enough to inoculate a population of 5 million. Even since the last year in May 2020, the United Nations asked Israel to have mercy on the hundreds of Palestinian children that it keeps in its jails and to release them for fear that they might catch COVID or spark an outbreak. Israel ignored this request and is still illegally detaining Palestinian children, just as we saw a few days ago in Hebron, continuing to brutalize them and doesn't even care to release them or inoculate them, putting their health at further risk. And in December of 2020, initially, Israel's public security minister, Amir Ohana, refused to allow Palestinian prisoners to be vaccinated in Israeli jail, and only for prison staff to be vaccinated. He even defied the orders of the health minister. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Is Asa Winstanley, investigative journalist and podcaster for Electronic Intifada. He writes extensively about Palestine. He's lived in Palestine. Thanks so much for taking the time, Asa. It's good to have you on.
Great to be with you, Richard. I've been a fan of your show, and you're doing really great work, so it's brilliant to be on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, Asa, I want to start out with the medical apartheid that's happening in occupied Palestine. You know, the Israelis are refusing to vaccinate Palestinians. What did you think of this idea that Israel wants to send vaccines to countries that will move their embassy to Jerusalem?
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, Israel uses all tools that it can in the world, you know, to try and put pressure on countries to favor its international goals, you know. I mean, it uses all kinds of nefarious methods, so it's not completely surprising. But you're right, I mean, it's a typically despicable thing for them to do. And, you know, they the thing that struck me as well was they started this program for vaccines for foreign diplomats living in Tel Aviv mostly, although of course the Americans have moved to Jerusalem now, and they're going to be vaccinating them, you know, but still there's millions of Palestinians living in territories controlled by Israel that have not been vaccinated and have no entitlement to vaccines under Israeli apartheid.
So, I mean, how is the situation looking now? Because, you know, Israel says, oh, we're number one in vaccinations, but they're not counting the Palestinians that they're occupying. And now in March, Israel says they'll start vaccinating some of the Palestinian workers that cross over. So, I mean, is that it? Is that as far as it goes?
Under Israel's apartheid system, only the Jews, only the Israeli Jews have an entitlement to all sorts of different privileges, you know, and this is Israel's apartheid system. 6 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have no basic human or political rights under Israel's apartheid system. This is why it's called apartheid system, which, you know, there's literally different legal system for them. So this extends to the entitlement to vaccines as well. And it's only after Israel's come under massive amount of pressure and international criticism that they've even begun offering even a small token amount of Palestinians, the Palestinians who work in Israeli settlements, work in what's called Israel proper, beyond the green line, supposed, offering a limited amount of them some vaccines. And it's only, you know, because of this the description of it as vaccine apartheid, it's become a very sensitive issue for them. So they've offered these few vaccines, and now they're saying, well, it's not apartheid because, you know, we're offering some Palestinians the vaccine.
So, I mean, all these Israeli officials now, they're responding to this criticism by saying that it's anti-Semitic. And, you know, they even got mad at this SNL joke. I mean, what is that? Is that obscene how they're calling out anyone who exposes their refusal to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention as anti-Semitic?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tactic. This is Israel's tactic, isn't it? It's always Israel's tactic is to distract from its crimes by accusing its critics of having some sort of ulterior motive. You know, and the Saturday Night Live incident was a good example of that. You know, there was this comedian, Michael Che, I think you say his name, who made this joke of that Israel is reporting that they vaccinated half of their population, and I'm going to guess that it's the Jewish half. Well, it was a joke. It was quite a funny joke. But it was basically true, you know, because Israel was offering only, as I said, like the Jewish half of the population was really the only people who were offered the vaccine. And what illustrates that more than ever is the fact that Israeli settlers in the West Bank, even, which even under international law, which, you know, the US and everyone, Britain claims to abide by but doesn't, even under that law, those settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. Well, only Jews can live in them. And Israeli Jewish citizens living in those settlements, illegal settlements, were given and had right to the vaccine, but the Palestinians living in nearby communities were not. You know, so that's just a perfect example of it. And yeah, Israel's strategy is always to accuse its critics of anti-Semitism, and starting with the Palestinians.
So, I mean, Israel, they're saying that the Oslo Accords relieve them of their obligation to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Do you think it's true that a bilateral agreement can just cancel out a superseding international law, which is universal, essentially?
No, of course not. I mean, even the Oslo Accords themselves, which, you know, in my view, are illegitimate anyway, but even the Oslo Accords themselves state that Israel has an obligation to provide the Palestinian Authority with support during pandemics, you know. So it doesn't relieve Israel of its obligations under international law to provide basic services. Of course, in reality, the whole goal of the Oslo Accords was to essentially subcontract out Israeli occupation to, you know, a an indigenous agent, essentially. You know, like all settler colonial powers, like all instances of imperialism, Israel relies on, tries to, and in certain circumstances has been, you know, has had some measures of success to recruit native agents for its power. You know, like the British, when they occupied India, would set different religious communities against each other in order to kind of to divide and rule and to increase their power. So the Israelis know that the Palestinian Authority can keep knows its population better than they could possibly, and it's kind of a mask for them. It's a way for them to kind of launder their image and get away from fulfilling its obligations under international law.
Yeah, and now some Arab countries as well. And, you know, I'm a bit curious because I know it's a rhetorical question, I think, but, you know, the ICC is probing Israel for war crimes, and now we have Israel violating the Geneva Convention yet again. Do you think that there are going to be any actual consequences for what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in regards to depriving them of vaccines? I know that's kind of a rhetorical question. I don't think anyone is going to actually do anything to them, but what do you think the long-term effects of this will be?
The ICC investigation is an interesting one because it's true, you know, that it's been very slow in happening. The chief prosecutor of the ICC has announced this and she's on her way out. To clarify, she hasn't been sacked, but she's stepping down from her role, and just before she stepped down, I can't remember if it was just before or just after, but round about the same time she stepped down, she's finally, after years of talking about it and kind of prevaricating, said, okay, we are going to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Now, it's interesting because I think the ICC... if you look at the record of the ICC, I'm not an expert on it, but I think we all know and we can all see that almost only the only people that the ICC has prosecuted so far are political leaders who are black Africans, essentially, who are accused of war crimes. And the war crimes of the West and of Israel have not been touched by it. So I think as an international body, these international bodies like the UN and the International Criminal Court and the World Court as well before it, as ostensibly international bodies, I think they do come under pressure to an extent from people in, you know, what used to be called the Third World, the Global South, and the political leaders there who are starting to notice, hang on, you're only prosecuting black Africans. What's going on here? You know, what about Britain's crimes in Iraq? What about the US crimes in Afghanistan? You know, what about the European colonial crimes? You know, if we're going back in time, you know, all over the world. And in a way, in some ways, Israel is the last outpost of European colonialism that is still ongoing as a active settler colonial project. You know, the French were driven out of Algeria by an anti-colonial rebellion. You know, if you go back further, Haiti was the first state in the world to abolish slavery when the former enslaved Africans liberated themselves from the brutality of French slavery, and then they fought off, you know, they fought off three colonial powers: the British, the Spanish, and the French, to become free. So, like, Israel is a settler colonial project which is still ongoing in this way, which was launched by a Western European power under the auspices of the British Empire. So I suppose in a way the ICC agreeing to prosecute that, it could be the start of something, which is why it has been viewed as dangerous by the British government and the US government, with the US government even sanctioning the chief prosecutor of the ICC, you know, at Israel's behest, at Israel's request. And that was done under the Trump administration. The same sanctions are under place, you know, even though Biden's the great white hope. Yeah, they're still in place. So these vindictive Trump sanctions are still being enforced by the Biden administration. So it depends. Let's see what happens. There are some very good Palestinian lawyers who have been working for many years now to try and use these institutions to get what they're ostensibly designed to do, right? Which is achieve justice for people who have been subjected to these crimes.
I want to remind you very briefly of Israel's recent history and how it treats healthcare workers, doctors, and what it does to Palestinian health infrastructure, right? Do you remember during 2009, during Operation Castlet, Israel purposely deprived Palestinians of food, of medical supplies, of essential care, and deliberately blocked and otherwise impeded emergency relief and humanitarian assistance, and purposely targeted vehicles that were carrying humanitarian relief and violated international law. In 2014, during Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, Israel killed over 2,200 Palestinians. 65% of them were civilians. The UN found that, quote, 17 hospitals, 56 primary healthcare facilities, and 45 ambulances were damaged or destroyed. The total cost to Gaza's healthcare system, $50 million. 16 healthcare workers were killed, and 83, most of them ambulance drivers and volunteers, were injured. Then also in 2018, 2019, during the Right to Return marches, Israel purposely shot at and targeted unarmed Palestinians, wounding thousands of them and killing over 180. Among them, medical staff. A report by the United Nations found that Israeli snipers intentionally shot healthcare workers despite seeing that they were clearly marked as such. One of those healthcare workers was 20-year-old Ruzan El-Najjar, who worked tirelessly as a medic to help the injured and tend to the wounded. Her death caused widespread outrage, and the Israeli occupation forces even tried to smear her after one of their own snipers deliberately killed her. Gaza itself, which has been devastated by Israel's ruthless bombings over and over, has been under siege from Israel and Egypt since 2007, with only limited humanitarian supplies being allowed through. Even construction materials are not permitted. Israel literally picks and chooses what Palestinians in Gaza can bring into their own country. A UN report from 2009 states that the Israeli blockade is one of the main reasons there is not enough medical equipment or medical supplies available. All this to say that Israel is no problem killing medical workers and medics and doctors and destroying medical and public health infrastructure belonging to Palestinians. So of course, when it suits Israel, Israel claims that Palestinians are autonomous and that they can deal with their own health issues. And yet when something doesn't suit them, like the International Criminal Court saying it will investigate them for war crimes, then all of a sudden, Israel claims that this is not possible, that Palestine is not a real state, and the ICC can't expand jurisdiction there. Sheer hypocrisy. This is what occupation looks like. This is Israel's true face, not the one that they sell you in the mainstream media about how Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a fairy tale slogan. Israel is not a democracy. Israel is a racist, colonialist, settler project that was created by the United Kingdom. Israel treats Palestinians like they are less than human. Israel, since its foundation, has been ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people, bulldozing their homes, turning them into refugees, killing them in cold blood. Israel is one of the biggest human rights violators on the face of this planet. It has no respect for the Geneva Convention, nor for international law. Israel has purposely targeted public health infrastructure, purposely targeted medical workers, purposely targeted nurses, doctors, and paramedics, and this is documented by virtually every single news outlet and human rights organization that exists. So it's absolutely no surprise that an apartheid, genocidal regime like that would now deprive Palestinians of a vaccine, even during a global pandemic, on their own land, and then try to whitewash its racist apartheid crimes and boast about how successful it is. This is just another chapter in Israel's long and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people, its cruel and inhumane treatment of them during war and during occupation. This depraved, wicked treatment of Palestinians will go down in history as one of the worst crimes against humanity. And people will scratch their heads how the entire world, including many Arab nations, stood by watching and did nothing. It's an absolute disgrace, and anyone with a conscience can see that. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden said on Monday, 10th of May, that the United States would disrupt and prosecute a criminal gang of hackers called DarkSid, which the FBI formally blamed for the huge ransomware attack that has disrupted the flow of nearly half of the gasoline and jet fuel supplies to the east coast of the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist David Sanger and Nicole Perloff. The piece is titled, FBI Identifies Group Behind Pipeline Hack. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Monday, 10th of May, that the United States would disrupt and prosecute a criminal gang of hackers called DarkSid, which the FBI formally blamed for a huge ransomware attack that has disrupted the flow of nearly half of the gasoline and jet fuel supplies to the east coast of the United States. The FBI clearly concerned that the ransomware effort could spread, issued an emergency alert to electric